This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking with Dan Nardello, who founded Nardello & Co. 21 years ago to advise companies on business intelligence and investigations. Dan also advises corporations on activist defense strategies, among other matters, and the firm, which is ranked first by Chambers and Partners for Business Intelligence and Investigations, works with a large number of what I would consider like the top tier activist defense law firms, including Wachtell, Sullivan, Kirkland, Paul Weiss, and Nardello, a lawyer by training, previously served as a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. And in addition to securities cases, Dan prosecuted organized crime, civil rights, and corruption matters. And today, as a private investigator, he teaches a course to major law firms on ethical and legal considerations when retaining investigators. Thank you, Dan, for taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, so let's get right to it. You provide intelligence and investigative services to both companies that are, I consider the term peacetime, not currently facing activists. And I believe also those who are facing a live activist campaign. Tell me if that's correct. And then maybe tell me a little bit about what kind of investigations Nardello & Co. provides to companies picking C-suite and board candidates. I feel like this is a very important topic. And I don't know if you could kind of break it down between peacetime and contest time, but advice for picking director candidates.
Your description is absolutely correct. And I don't know if we should break it down between peacetime and wartime, because everything that we do in onboarding or helping companies onboard officers and directors is done with an eye towards obviating a potential activist attack. Mm-hmm. So we're called upon companies to do deep background investigations of their C-suite appointments as well as board appointments. And what we do there is the same thing in our investigation. We're looking for the same themes that an activist would use in wartime, to use your So integrity problems, issues around self-dealing, potential litigation, Me Too issues. We're helping a company evaluate candidates. Those are the sorts of things we're trying to suss out.
I feel like though in like wartime, or in, you know, when there's a contest underway and they retain you guys or hire you guys, there's a lot of pressure under a shorter time frame, maybe.
That's 100% right. That's 100% right. But going back to your first point, I'll use a cliche, but it really is appropriate in this sense. An ounce of prevention isn't worth a pound of cure. Mm-hmm. So if we can help a company onboard folks who are not going to have low-lying vulnerabilities, half our job is done. And in fact, more recently, we've been asked to a company that's facing, is anticipating an activist attack. We've been asked to come in and, even if we haven't done the diligence originally, we've been asked to come in and take a look at existing boards and senior officers, so they're not surprised by what an activist might find.
Yeah, this is a big issue, right? Sometimes companies will vet their directors, and then 10 years go by, they're still on the board. A lot of things can happen in the interim. They should be vetting those directors more frequently, no?
Yeah, I think there is a danger in hiring someone, doing the background investigation, you know, at point A, and not refreshing it at least every so often, because things change. And we're also in an environment where things that might not have resonated as problems 10 years ago may really resonate now. One example of it is sort of Me Too issues and the constellation of issues that are coming out of that, just abusive behavior, anger management, intemperate remarks may have been tolerated 10 or 15 years ago in a way that is no longer acceptable. So
the initial vetting might not have caught that as a problem, but now
even if it caught some of it, may not have thought it the same level of problem as it might now be.
Okay. So what other kinds of red flags have you identified? When we chatted before, you talked about the potential for excessive private use of a corporate jet. I know that activists frequently are digging into use of corporate jets, use of it too much. And they have identified private use of corporate jets, which even if it's a kind of fraction of, a company's costs, I feel like it is something that resonates with institutional and retail investors as a problem. And also, I believe, tell me if I'm correct, you found sometimes inconsistencies between resumes and career details. That's also something that I've seen activists pick up on with some success.
Yeah. Well, the issue of the use of corporate jets, I mean, look, with most public corporations, senior staff, senior officers, certainly CEOs, if they're using a private jet, they're using it in accordance with whatever the policies are. And oftentimes they're fairly liberal and they're allowed to use them for security reasons for their own personal travel. But, if that's abused, that could certainly be an issue. Inconsistencies between resumes and what we actually find, that has happened a considerable amount, both in small details, which sometimes can be telling, and in major misstatements. We also look for gaps in resumes. If you see a gap in a resume, that could be illustrative of a particular problem.
Like a number of years where nothing was reported. Yeah, 5 years, yeah. No career.
I'll tell you a war story that has nothing to do about a gap in a resume. It wasn't in an activist context, but when I was a prosecutor, I was in an insider trading case. We were interviewing a potential witness who claimed to be a whistleblower. We saw a gap in his resume and we drilled down into it, and turns out he was in prison for murder in the 3 years that we're in accounting. Yeah. Now, I don't expect to find that often, but certainly a gap in a resume can be indicative of certain problems.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then another category, and I was thinking about this when you're bringing up the growth of Me Too movement issues, is social media. And I'm wondering if you review, and it's also an issue that's kind of, I think, exploded social media, that maybe wasn't such a big deal 10, 20 years ago. So I'm wondering, do you review the social media of the candidates, the director candidates and their spouses and family? I suspect like adult children. And
yeah, exactly.
Have you found any sort of problematic things in that category?
Yes, we do a deep dive into the social media of the candidate, adult children and spouses. Why? Because an intemperate remark or problematic postings on social media of a spouse or an adult child could reflect on that candidate and cause problems. I'll give you an example. We were doing a background investigation for I believe it was a CEO candidate, and we found that one of his sons, I think was 20 something, was posting really troubling messages with a racist connotation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a problem.
And really ugly stuff. The candidate was unaware of it, and remediation there was the son took it all down and was given a talking to about the issue. And so the candidate was able to proceed. The candidate himself was unblemished. You could see where an activist could use that and configure it in a way to hurt the CEO.
Yeah, that could definitely be damning. And I'm also wondering, do you look into corporate credit card use? And the same thing with the private jets. Do you find sometimes personal use of corporate credit cards? That seems like a no-brainer. Don't use your corporate credit card for personal.
Well, as a matter of course, if we're looking at a potential candidate, we wouldn't have access to that. I have, in the course of internal investigations of one case in particular, always stays with me, of a CEO who looked into corporate credit card use. And in this particular case, obviously, I can't tell you who it is, but the CEO was using the credit card to wine and dine a much younger subordinate employee who he was having an affair with and paying for hotel rooms and travel. And so the upshot there was he was terminated.
Yeah, that's
properly so, frankly.
Definitely a red flag. Okay, so let's switch it over to the activist. So like in situations where you're advising a company targeted by an activist, yeah, there is an activist that is, maybe they don't have a proxy fight, or maybe they have what I like to call the poison pen letter and they've started agitating at the company. Is that some of what you do? Do you look at the activist investor, and what kind of things do you look for? Because as a reporter, I often look at how has that activist performed at other companies where they've agitated for change and sought directorships, or maybe where the investor has a director position for a portfolio manager or for the founder or CIO of the fund, you know, how have those companies performed? I always wonder whether you look at social media of activists. You know, there's a few activists that are actually quite prolific at posting on social media. I kind of have those tweets sent to my email so I can, you know, keep track of them. And one thing I would love to know is, and this became a big issue in this one activist situation that I followed recently and wrote several articles about it, but never figured out, was that who are the limited partner investors of the activist? They like to keep that very secret. The limited partner investors like to be secret about themselves, that they're investing with an activist for, you know, I suspect a variety of reasons, but have you ever been able to figure out who the LPs are to the activists? Is that something you look into?
The answer is yes. We're often asked to look at activists. We're looking for many of the same sorts of issues, but, you know, when we're looking at the fund, we're looking to see past performance, conflicts of interest, short-termism, misstatements or statements that are inconsistent with their present position, making this up, but, you know, maybe they've praised management that they're now attacking in the past, that sort of thing. We're looking for misrepresentations, misstatements, omissions in securities filings, undisclosed liabilities, litigation, integrity and reputational issues, you know, the same sorts of things that we're trying to obviate when we're looking at board and C-suite candidates. Sometimes we're also assessing or helping the, you know, the lawyers assess the strategies that they used in previous takeovers or proxy battles. So yes, to all of those things. We are often asked to try to identify limited partners. It is hard, but we've had some success because folks who do this work in our shop know how to navigate through the public record. It is not easy pickings, but if you dig hard enough, sometimes you can identify.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. So I did like a feature on private investigators a little bit ago, and I kind of did a little poll. I called up some activists and companies, and some said they hired private eyes themselves when they're campaigning at a company. A couple activists very frequently hire PIs to do work when they thinking about launching a campaign. And I think it helps them decide whether to launch a campaign. So they hire the PIs early on. But I wasn't really able to get some statistical data on it. I suspected you may know more. So one, do you feel like a lot of times activists will hire PIs when they're targeting companies? And then two, do you investigate the activists' private investigators?
The answer to both is yes. So I think the corporation that's under attack has to assume, I think the operating assumption has to be that the activist has engaged either external PIs or some of the funds have in-house investigators that do this work. But I think the operating assumption has to be that the activist has done that. And we have certainly seen in many of the contests that we have done, activists on the other side going out, knocking on doors, sometimes in a rather aggressive, crude way, asking the proverbial, when did he stop beating his wife, kinds of questions. And we have not only seen that behavior, but we, in a number of instances, both in our work in activist defense and in other situations, have investigated the other side's investigators. And I think you said earlier that I teach a course on ethical and legal
considerations. Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
We're alive to what the issues are. And we found all sorts of problematic activities by investigators working for activists, including not having the requisite license, which, you know, obtaining a private investigator's license, if you're in the business of conducting private investigations, it's not a big deal. It is not an intellectually very hefty thing to get, but people are very careless. We found investigators making misrepresentations about who they are, who they're working for, using pretext, pretending to be journalists when they're in fact private investigators. So we've seen a range of behavior that's not particularly kosher.
So do you feel like sometimes the activists, private investigators, overstep ethical bounds or even legal bounds? I'm trying to think of how to describe
it. Sometimes, I mean, not invariably. I wouldn't want to paint this with too broad a brush. But I've been in a number of contests where we've seen behavior that at the least was aggressive. And also, put aside for a moment whether it's legal or ethical, just not that smart and not necessarily calculated to get results that are going to resonate in the contest. And I have seen behavior that crossed the line, both ethically and legally.
Just to focus on that for a minute, is that, I guess, one of the reasons you have this course? I mean, tell me about the course. It takes place at the law firm offices. You kind of advise lawyers that are advising companies targeted by activists about ethical issues related to getting information? Or what is the course about?
The course is not just about activist content. It's a course for what is called in the legal profession, continuing legal education. It awards ethics credit, which is sometimes difficult to obtain. For practicing lawyers, it's a requirement that they take a certain number of legal education courses a year. And what it focuses on are the ethical and legal issues that lawyers who are supervising the work of investigators need to be alive to when they're engaging private investigators. So what's legal? Things like recording conversations, which are perfectly legal in states like New York, but not in California.
It varies state to state, yeah.
Yeah. So licensing issues, data privacy issues, there's a range of ethical and legal issues that have to be dealt with and attended to when you're engaging investigators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess you tell them to that not to pretend to be someone that they're not, I guess is...
Right, which is...
Kind of seems to be pretty obvious, but... Yeah.
And there's an affirmative duty on the lawyers who are engaging private investigators to supervise their work, and they can't turn a blind eye, put their head in the sand, and the ethical rules are pretty clear about this.
Okay, so we're almost out of time here, but I wanted to just delve into one more kind of category of your investigation as it pertains to activist situation. It seems like, tell me if I misinterpret this, but it seems like a lot of the kind of initial investigations that you will provide a company when, like, you know, vetting directors, for example, is a deep dive into data, legal documents, things like that. But will you or will Nardello and co investigators conduct interviews, the kinds of things it sounds like the activist private eyes are doing a lot of, interviews with employees, former employees, litigation adversaries, and or is that something that you do rarely? Is that something you do a lot? Is that like a whole kind of second step of this investigation? Like you typically will offer a deep dive into documents, and then if they want more, then you shift to the interviews, or how does that work?
Well, typically, and particularly if we have the time, we would do the work in public domain, open sources, anything that's available in the public record first. And in the course of that work, identify folks that we could speak to in a possible second stage. Corporations are sometimes reluctant to do the second phase of the work, meaning going out and talking to people, because I think they're just more conservative in their approach and they're anxious to having private investigators going out there in their name and knocking on doors. That is not always the case. And there have been numerous contests where we're in where we go out and we talk to people. And the key in that is to approach people in the right way, represent yourselves honestly, and have folks on your staff who know how to go and interview people and do it in an appropriate way. So you're not asking the question, when did he or she stop beating their spouse? But you're getting to the heart of the matter and to issues that are going to resonate and have relevance to the contest.
Mm-hmm. So maybe give me some examples of some of the different people that she, like, will you talk to former coworkers?
You can talk to, and not just in activist contests, but in litigation, in all sorts of the work we do, in white-collar criminal defense cases. You talk to former employees, you talk to litigation adversaries, disgruntled former business partners in the right context. And obviously, this is always done in coordination with the law firm and the ultimate client. We've even, not in an activist contest, but in other contests, we've talked to ex-spouses. So there's a range of people that you can talk to who might have information and have a motive as well to give you information about the other side.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is absolutely fascinating. This is a whole kind of piece of the activism situation that is often behind the scenes and we don't see much of in the public domain. So I appreciate you, Dan, taking the time to go over it. We are out of time, and this has been Ron Oral, and you've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast with Dan Nardello, who founded business intelligence and investigation firm Nardello & Co. Thanks, Dan, for taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Ron. Thank you.